I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. 5 years ago today, the war in Iraq began. In a few minutes, is it really a $3 trillion war? And how do you calculate the cost of a life lost? But first, President Bush today said the war has been worth it. The U.S. is winning. Last year's surge of troops into Iraq has turned the situation around. The U.S. should continue fighting until victory is at hand. And the president hailed what he called a major strategic victory in Iraq.
In Iraq, we're witnessing the first large-scale Arab uprising against Osama bin Laden, his grim ideology, and his murderous network. And the significance of this development cannot be overstated.
President Bush gave his speech at the Pentagon as anti-war protests took place across the country and the military death toll in Iraq nears 4,000 for U.S. victims. Dmitry Sevastopoulou is Pentagon and intelligence correspondent for the Financial Times. Dmitry, was there any acknowledgement of failure or disappointment today?
Robin, there wasn't really acknowledgement of failure. I think there was acknowledgement that the battle in Iraq had been, as Mr. Bush said, longer and harder and more costly than most people had anticipated. I think in that sense, his speech today was a little bit more realistic than usual. On the other hand, he hasn't dropped any of his goals about outright victory, about spreading democracy in the Middle East. And I think that is the same rosy language that we've heard for the last 5 years.
What about the president's claim that these awakening councils, the Sunni Arab fighters fighting foreign fighters connected with al-Qaeda, is the first large-scale Arab uprising against Osama bin Laden? Is that view widely held?
No, I don't think so. I think what you had in Anbar province in the west is you did have some Sunni sheikhs and tribal leaders who decided that al-Qaeda in Iraq or people affiliated with al-Qaeda were a little bit too brutal and they decided to ally with the Americans. That's probably true. But what you've had in Baghdad and other places is after the February 2006 bombing of the Golden Mosque, I think a lot of the Sunnis in Baghdad, when they saw the backlash from the Shia community, they realized that they didn't have a way to secure or protect themselves, and so they allied with the Americans. I think to say that an upscale Arab uprising against Osama bin Laden is stretching it way too far.
Yeah, some analysts have said to us it's just a matter of not wanting foreign fighters on their land. But what else jumped out at you?
Well, there are a couple of interesting things. I mean, at one point he said that if the U.S. allowed its quote-unquote enemies to prevail in Iraq, al-Qaeda would regain its lost sanctuaries, fomenting violence and terror. And he said this could spread beyond Iraq's borders and, quote, with serious consequences for the world's economy. Given that right now the world is looking at the subprime crisis in America, the failure of a big bank or investment bank, I should say, last week, Bear Stearns, to try and connect al-Qaeda with the world economy seems to be a little bit disingenuous at this point.
Well, there's intense debate in the Pentagon and among military experts about what's being called the invisible red line, you know, the amount of troops the U.S. military can sustain in Iraq.
Sure.
He, of course, President Bush today said, they will be there till victory. But we know that in April we have a report to Congress from General Petraeus. Do you think that at that time it will end this debate on the future of U.S. troops in Iraq? In other words, that we will know what's going to happen?
I think at this point it's fairly clear what's going to happen. General Petraeus, the top commander in Iraq, is going to recommend that after the surge is withdrawn this summer, you'll have roughly 130,000 to 140,000 troops left, that the U.S. should then have a strategic pause to assess whether removing those combat troops is going to allow violence to spike up again. President Bush today was very clear that any further drawdown could not, quote, jeopardize the hard-fought gains. He has aligned himself with General Petraeus publicly on several occasions. Robert Gates recently aligned himself with General Petraeus. While the Joint Chiefs and some of the other senior brass are concerned about stress on the military and this invisible red line, Admiral Mullen, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, last month said that he believed the current troop deployments could be sustained till the end of this year, probably without breaking the army in particular. So I think what you're going to have is 130,000, 140,000 troops in Iraq for the rest of the year, and then the next president is going to have to pick up the baton from there.
Dmitry Sevastopoulou, Pentagon and intelligence correspondent for the Financial Times after President Bush's speech to the Pentagon today. Dmitry, thank you very much.
Thank you, Robin.
Well, you've heard President Bush's assessment of the war 5 years on. Today and tomorrow, we're going to take a look at Iraq from several points points of view. And we continue today with Dr. Haider al-Abadi. He's a member of Iraq's parliament and an advisor to Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki. A year ago, Dr. al-Abadi told us that the troop surge was necessary to help create order, but that a phased withdrawal within a year was a key next step. Well, Dr. al-Abadi, welcome back to Here and Now.
Thank you very much for having me again this year.
Well, here we are a year later. General Petraeus and others have hinted that there might be a pause in withdrawal this summer instead of the expected drawdown. Your thoughts?
Well, by all means, due to military considerations, this is very important. But the policy which we are seeking is a gradual reduction in overall U.S. and foreign forces on Iraqi soil. We are aware that the U.S. public wants their soldiers back home. We are very eager to receive the responsibility, that is security responsibility, from these forces as soon as possible to allow these forces to go back home.
Why haven't Iraqi forces stepped up more? You know, there's been disappointment in the training of Iraqi forces that they haven't been able to reach the level. You told us last year that you wanted Iraqi forces to be able to fly the helicopters and fly the airplanes in addition to doing the groundwork. And there's a sense that that's not happening.
No, indeed. There is a huge departure from last year. I'll give you one example. 2 weeks ago, we had this religious festival in Karbala. About 9 million people attended. Not a single terrorist attack within the perimeter of Karbala, which is about 20 kilometers away. Yes, there was one incident, which was about 40 kilometers away, but not a single incident inside that perimeter. And this is overseen by Iraqi security forces. This shows how much the Iraqi security forces have developed since last year.
Let's look to political gains, though. Your government, led by Prime Minister Maliki, is predominantly Shia. We're reading today the minority Sunni bloc boycotted this week's reconciliation conference. They say Sunni detainees have not been charged with crimes, Shia militias haven't been disbanded, and Maliki hasn't included Sunnis in decision-making. How about the political gains?
This is not true, because the prime minister, he has a number of ministers who are Sunnis in his cabinet. He's got a number of Sunnis in his decision-making circle. So it is not true.
It had to be disappointing, though, that this large Sunni bloc boycotted what was supposed to be a reconciliation conference. How do you deal with at least the perception, even if you feel it's not a reality, the perception that there's an inequality? How do you move past that?
Well, we are moving very fast on that. Yes, it is a perception. People are free to say whatever they think. In such a democratic atmosphere, people are free to boycott, to pull out of government, to pull out of parliament, and to pull out from any meeting. This is democracy in Iraq.
Dr. al-Abadi, are you hopeful about Iraq's future?
Well, as I told you last year, we are very hopeful. This is our country. We are not going to cut and run our country. This year, the prime minister and the whole government and the whole parliament is concentrating on reconstructing Iraq and rebuilding Iraq. And we are achieving quite a milestone in this so far. We have allocated a huge budget to the reconstruction of Iraq and reinvestment in the Iraqi infrastructure. And Iraqis are taking over the responsibility of their country now, and they are doing the job.
Dr. Haider al-Abadi, he's a member of the Iraqi parliament, chair of the Investment and Reconstruction Committee. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Well, now another view of the war in Iraq as it enters its sixth year, an accounting of the costs in dollars and cents. The Pentagon puts that number at $600 billion and counting. Our next guest says that figure is way off. Linda Bilmes teaches public finance at the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard. She is co-author with Nobel Prize-winning economist Joseph Stiglitz of the much-discussed new bestseller, The $3 Trillion War, The True Cost of the Iraq Conflict. She joins us in the studio. Welcome.
Thank you, Robin.
We should say your book title is $3 trillion, but Stiglitz has said the long-term cost is closer to $4 trillion. Give us some context first. We know Iraq, the second most expensive war in American history, behind only the Second World War, and that mobilized 16 million Americans. Give us some more context for how much Iraq is costing compared to other conflicts.
Iraq is very different from other conflicts, both in the way that it is being waged and in the way that we're financing it. This is the first war since the Revolutionary War where we are borrowing a lot of money from overseas. You remember that during the Revolutionary War, the colonies borrowed from France to pay for the war. Now we are borrowing 40% of the money to wage the war from countries like China and Middle Eastern countries. And this is also the first war in U.S. history where we have cut taxes and raised spending at the same time that we went to war. We have essentially deferred the entire cost of the war onto the next generation.
Is it the first war that's 100% deficit spending?
Yes, it is. It's the first war in U.S. history where we have financed it entirely by borrowing.
Well, we want to go through some of the numbers, but of course there's been White House response. Today, President Bush said some are exaggerating the costs of the war. White House spokesperson Dana Perino acknowledged today in the New York Times that the cost had risen higher than was predicted, but then goes on to say that none of the calculations like yours takes into account the cost of failure in Iraq. Should al-Qaeda have safe haven in Iraq, we are more likely to be attacked again on our homeland, and we know the cost of that. And previously in the Boston Phoenix, the White House said the same thing. You know, it's an investment in the future safety and security of Americans, and the cost of failure is much higher than the cost you're calculating for the war. Your response?
Well, first of all, the White House doesn't have a very good track record in terms of figuring out the cost of the war. Initially, they said the war would cost $50 billion, and even their own economic advisor, Larry Lindsey, said it would cost $200 billion, and he was fired. Then 2 years ago, we said it would cost $1 trillion to $2 trillion. They said it would cost less. And now even the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office says it's going to cost $2.5 trillion. So I think that the White House really does not have a very good handle on what the war is costing. Now, in terms of the second issue, which is what are the benefits of the war or is it worth it? The president is trying to say, essentially, well, we know that the war is incredibly expensive, but there are benefits that are worth it. And I think the public will have to decide whether or not they agree with that. What we do know is that we have already spent $600 billion in cash costs. We know that we have already spent double that if you include the cost that we would have to pay even if we pulled out tomorrow, such as taking care of wounded veterans and replacing military equipment that has been used up and paying interest on all the money that we borrowed. And going forward, the full cost of staying in Iraq, even forgetting about Afghanistan for a moment, is $25 billion a month. So that's $300 billion a year. And we really have to think about whether our national security objectives are best achieved by using that money to deploy our overstretched military personnel in Iraq for years to come. And that is the question that is facing the next president.
Linda Bilmes teaches public finance at the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard and is co-author of the new book, The $3 Trillion War, The True Cost of the Iraq Conflict. We'll come back with, you know, more of a look inside her ledger. How did she come to these numbers? Later in the show, Barack Obama's speech yesterday is being called brilliant. It provoked tears. But will it move undecided white voters? We'll have that in the program as well. Back in 1 minute, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and we're back with more from Linda Bilmes. She teaches public finance at the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard and is co-author of the new bestseller, The $3 Trillion War, The True Cost of the Iraq Conflict. And Linda, before the break, you ticked through some of the reasons your estimate is much larger than the Pentagon's, you know, hidden budgets, but also resetting the military, replacing old equipment, that means, or paying for the interest on foreign loans to finance the war, also the long-term medical costs of the war. What kind of numbers are you looking at there?
Well, we believe that the cost of providing disability benefits and medical care to our troops will be in the range of $600 billion over the course of their lifetime. But I just want to say that this is because not only of the high survival rate, but also the scale of the needs of the returning troops who have been out there for deployments, many of them two or three deployments of 15 months each, and we have already seen 300,000 returning troops be treated at the veterans hospitals and clinics, about a third of those for mental health conditions such as post-traumatic stress disorder, which are expensive to treat and take a long time.
We've talked about this before. You cite other ways the costs rise. And we hasten to say, as we always do when we have this conversation, of course, the emotional cost is far greater than any that we can that we're calculating with numbers. But you write about, for instance, the cost of a spouse or parent who has to quit a job to take care of a wounded veteran. We've met them. Or the cost of disability to young people who then can't participate in the economy, so aren't putting back into the economy.
Right. And one of the costs that we explain in our book is the cost that the federal government doesn't pay. And we know anecdotally that if a soldier returns who is seriously wounded and they go back home, there are many costs that the government does not pay but that fall on that individual and his family and his community. For example, very often a spouse or a parent will have to quit their job in order to become a full-time or part-time caretaker. They will have to drive long distances to seek medical care for that individual. The individual, even if they can recover, is very unlikely to be able to do the kind of job or work that they were able to do before. And all of these costs are costs to the economy, which we cannot overlook, even though they're costs that the federal government doesn't pay.
When you talk about the cost of the war, you also talk about what could have been done with that money. As you write, it could have funded Social Security for 75 years. Hillary Clinton also says it could have provided health care for 47 million uninsured or give quality pre-kindergarten for every American child. People are making these calculations. But others, you know, critics of that kind of thinking remind us that, in fact, that's not really true because this is deficit spending. The money isn't there to pay for other things.
Well, I think that what's important is that the money that we've spent so far, even though we have borrowed the money, we have spent it on things which are not productive investments for the United States. So if you look at where the money goes every month, it's going into fuel in Iraq. It's going into contractors from the Philippines stationed in Iraq.
Let me hold you up there because that's a point that you and others make, that it's not as if we're paying Iraqis to rebuild their roads. It's not an investment in the country of Iraq. Much of the money spent isn't investing in either Iraq or America.
Well, that's right. I mean, we're not building productive investments like roads and tunnels and schools in the United States. We are not even, to a large extent, building those things in Iraq.
Because we've relied on foreign contractors in so much of the
cases.
Well,
I mean, we have. What we have done is we have privatized a lot of the military operations far beyond what I think makes sense for our country. Because a contractor, however competent they may be, they have a very different agenda than the U.S. military does. For example, right after the fall of Saddam Hussein, there were 1 million unemployed young men in Iraq. So our objective as a country was to provide jobs for those young men. But the contractors who were doing the work and the reconstruction, their objective, as always, is to minimize costs and increase profits to their shareholder. So instead of employing local Iraqis, they employed cheaper Nepalis and Filipinos and others who could do that work.
So you say it's billions, trillions of dollars that's not even money that's going to grow in the future. It's not an investment, as you said. And that brings us back to where we started, President Bush saying that it's an investment in security. But I can hear Americans saying, what am I supposed to do about it? Either way, you know, what am I supposed to do about these huge numbers of dollars being spent on the war in Iraq?
Well, I think that the president has made the argument that we are not wrong about the cost of the war, but that it's worth it. And that's essentially his argument. And we are quite certain that if you look back to 5 years ago, anyone looking at this and comparing the cost of this war to the cost of what we were doing then, which was flying the no-fly zones and containing Saddam Hussein, would say that this has not been a wise use of $3 trillion. So the question going forward is, considering that it is going to cost us another $300 billion a year to stay in Iraq, what are we really getting for our money? Are we really seriously buying security? And I am not a military expert. I'm a budget expert. But I think that it's an important part of this conversation to understand the true costs of the war, which are not just the short-term costs, but the long-term costs. And I also think that it's an important part of this conversation to think not just about whether we carry on, but how we continue to pay for this war. And if we do continue to fight the war, do we want to continue financing it entirely through borrowing, which entails very little sacrifice by us and puts the entire burden of the paying for the war onto our children? That is a major sort of punt to the next generation that has taken place over the last 5 years. And if Senator McCain is elected and he wants to continue this war, I think that people should ask whether that's the right way to pay for it.
Linda Bilmes teaches public finance at the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard. She's co-author with Nobel Prize-winning economist Joseph Stiglitz of the new bestseller, The $3 Trillion War, The True Cost of the Iraq Conflict. Linda, thanks as always for coming by.
Thank you very much again.
Well, tomorrow on Here and Now, we'll continue our look at Iraq 5 years on after the war, and we'll speak to an Iraqi who now lives in the U.S. because her life was endangered in Iraq. She was a translator for American newspapers. We'll hear what her friends and family are saying on emails, including the latest jokes running around Baghdad that really aren't very funny. That's tomorrow. Still ahead today, who's looking at your emails, your digital shadow? Back after the news, Here and Now. Under fire, Obama tackles race relations head-on, writes the editorial board of USA Today. The New York Times saw shades of JFK, calling the speech Mr. Obama's profile in courage. The Philadelphia Inquirer said the speech was brilliant. Conservative editorial boards at the Wall Street Journal, Washington Times, and Boston Herald chided Obama for not walking away from his church and the controversial minister, Jeremiah Wright, who often railed against the U.S. and white Americans. Conservative columnist Jeff Jacoby, writing in the Boston Globe, said it was a graceful speech, but if his rabbi had spouted the same words, he would have demanded that rabbi be fired. So the speech provoked heated debate, tears. But will it win over voters? Terry Madonna is a political scientist at Franklin and Marshall College in Lancaster, Pennsylvania. He told us earlier today that the speech was better than Kennedy's on faith and politics, but might not reach some of the middle-class white voters that Obama pointedly singled out and sympathized with. Well, the next big primary contest is in the swing state of Pennsylvania. Rural Scranton voted Democratic in the last election, but here are some callers' comments on Obama today on Sue Henry's talk show on WILK.
I thought he did a great job of explaining why there's racism in the black and the white community, but he didn't do a very good job of explaining why he would still sit in a church like that.
Either he believes what his preacher is telling him, or he doesn't care what his children are learning. It scares me. That's all I can say.
He was a new face, and as his campaign goes on, he's starting to become more just like all the other politicians, and he's getting caught in lies. It seems he's saying whatever he has to say just to keep people happy. He's starting to lose his momentum, so to speak.
Radio callers in Scranton, Pennsylvania today. Well, Pat Walker is executive editor of the Bucks County Courier-Times, an area that's been traditionally Republican but has voted for Democratic candidates in the last few elections. Pat, your paper also covered voter reaction in your area. What did people say?
Many of our readers said they appreciate the speech, they appreciate the explanation, but they really want the candidates to focus on what they believe are the issues most desperate to our country, which are jobs, the economy, and the war. And one of our readers today said there's two things you don't talk about, race and religion, because no one's going to agree on that. And that seems to be the consensus here, is we accept the explanation. Okay, now let's get to what really matters.
Well, as eloquent as it was, and we're hearing other people say, thank goodness someone is finally talking about those issues. Political scientist Terry Madonna also told us that this might make Obama the official voice of race relations while Hillary Clinton is out campaigning on just those issues your readers say they want to hear about, school loans and the war. So as astonishing and welcome as this has been for many of Obama's supporters, what do you think it does for him?
It may widen the divide. We heard from folks yesterday who said that Mrs. Clinton's speech, which also was in Philadelphia yesterday morning, hit on issues that resonated quickly with our community. The major Interstate 95 here was shut down for the last 2 days, basically, you know, cutting off the city from the suburbs because of some stretch fractures on a bridge. And she zeroed in, talked about infrastructure problems we have across this country. She zeroed in on domestic issues of jobs and the economy, and people's ears perked up. So while his speech was eloquent, hers seemed yesterday to zero in on the issues that really are affecting my readership here.
Well, it's funny because Terry McDonaghan, a political scientist, told us that it reminded him of William Jennings Bryant, who would bring people to tears but then didn't have a follow-through on a speech. But then again, we rush to say that there are people who are saying this may finally open up a needed dialogue. I mean, Governor Rendell of Pennsylvania, Clinton supporter, said in the past that his opponent, the former football star Lynn Swann, would have done much better in their race if Swann were not black, because Rendell said there were conservative whites in Pennsylvania just not ready to vote for a black man. Might Obama, you know, reach those white middle-class voters that he so eloquently spoke of in the speech?
I think he will. I think he will reach that audience. I believe that his message is out there. There are the 25 to 35-year-olds in our communities that are, their ears are perked up about this election. They're interested in this election. They haven't been before. They feel that the senator speaks to them. And I think his words will draw them in.
Well, one problem, though, we were thinking, and we said this yesterday, they may not hear those words because we live in a soundbite nation. And so I'm going to read some of them now, the words that are not making the, you know, the top few cuts that everyone's playing about Barack Obama's grandmother, et cetera.
Right.
Here's what he said to, you know, resentful middle-class whites. He said they're squeezed. He listed globalization and other issues. They've built their lives from scratch. When they hear an African-American is getting an advantage in landing a good job or a spot in a good college because of an injustice they didn't commit, or that their fears about crime in urban neighborhoods are somehow prejudiced, resentment builds over time. He said he understood that, and he said, your dreams, he said to whites, your dreams don't have to come at the expense of mine. You know, something that we just haven't heard, that hasn't been a part of the national dialogue.
Correct. And he does then, I think, resonate and will resonate with the, you know, your average white middle-class American if he speaks to those issues. There's this swell out there of folks who, and we've heard them today, who said, you know, he should disassociate himself with his church. He should have stepped away from that. He should have jettisoned that. Others who think you can disagree, but you don't have to leave something behind. You know, you can stick with an issue even though everyone in the room doesn't agree.
Well, we mentioned the grandmother. And,
right.
You know, in saying why he did not abandon, as he phrased it, this minister, he said he could no more abandon his grandmother, who said that she was frightened sometimes when a black man came by or said other racist things that made him as a young child wince. You know, there's the sort of, you know, as we said, racist in everyone's closet. Are people talking about that today?
I think so. We quoted in our newspaper today the president of our local NAACP chapter, who said that, you know, he believes, unfortunately, that racism still is alive and well in our community, and that it's, you know, he believes it's critical for it to be pointed out that there are many folks, you know, who profess they are not bigoted or biased, but in fact are. And what you said before about people saying, you know, we've been denied jobs because of diversity factors or because of what they perceive as quotas of hiring, I think that's an undercurrent that is there across this country, not just here in Pennsylvania, but I think across this country, that there is that resentment. That's the talk that goes on around the kitchen table, not the talk that perhaps goes out in public.
Pat Walker, executive editor of the Bucks County Courier-Times, checking in from Pennsylvania on Barack Obama's speech yesterday. Pat, thanks so much.
You're welcome, Robin.
What do you think? We want to hear your thoughts. You can write them to letters at here-now.org. That's letters at here-now.org. We'd love to hear from you. And don't forget, while you're at the website, you can always listen to our program stream live or download a podcast. Before we go today, the untold story of the hospital at Ellis Island. You're listening to Here and Now. Well, every time you do log on, buy something online or go to your email or do a Google search, you're adding clutter to an already overcrowded digital universe. And the information that others create about each of us, from credit card transactions to medical records, has for the first time surpassed the amount of data we create about ourselves. It's called a digital shadow. So much data is being created that soon there physically won't be enough computer hard drive space to store it all. Mark Lewis of EMC Corporation, a software and data storage company, co-authored a study on the digital shadow. He joins us. Welcome, Mark.
Thanks, Robin.
And I should say, you're a storage company. Maybe you're just trying to scare us about storing all of our information. Why did you even look into this?
Well, as a storage company, we kind of needed to know and wanted to know, were people really storing more information and what type of information was being stored?
Well, there are two aspects. There's the digital footprint that we create. We take digital pictures or make calls over the Internet, use YouTube. That's the footprint we leave. Then there's a digital shadow. It sounds so nefarious. What is that?
We have a lot of information created about us or created because we're doing certain things. When we make a transaction over the web or even with a credit card, we're creating a transaction log. When we go to the doctor and get a test run, we're creating a log and a set of test results. So as we go through life, even as we get walked by a surveillance camera, there's a whole large amount of digital information that is created either about us or has us engaged in that. Your digital shadow can be a great thing. It's maintaining things like your health records and like the music you like to buy or the books you like to purchase. And so it can be incredibly valuable information, but obviously we also want to make sure that information is used properly.
Well, especially in Britain, which has an estimated 5 million surveillance cameras, and we read that someone living there can expect to have their image captured 300 times a day. What does it matter outside of the questions people have about the security of that information? What does it matter? Isn't that what the computer and the Internet was for?
We also need to be aware of it. We need to understand it and to make sure that where we desire our privacy to be retained, we actively look at doing that. We need to make sure personally that we're taking charge of that information and we're protecting it properly and we're securing it in appropriate ways, just as we would if with our photos or jewelry in our house.
I read that there now are 281 billion gigabytes. That works out to 45 gigabytes per person. Tell us more about megabytes, gigabytes, and exabytes.
A typical, movie that's standard definition might be 2 gigabytes or 3 gigabytes. That's kind of a standard for a movie. A camera photo, might be, in a high-definition camera, might be 4 or 5 megabytes. So you can see a lot of storage gets consumed by these various rich media. But I'll tell you, the simplest way to think about it is, if you look at the digital storage today, this digital universe that is 281 billion gigabytes, that's essentially more stars than there are in the universe today.
You say the creation of a larger digital universe also has environmental implications. What do you mean by that?
Well, obviously, every piece of computer equipment and every disk drive that we have out there consumes energy, consumes power to run it. And so we're looking at more and more ways to still have information readily available and to, support the expanding digital footprint while still taking more in mind the environmental impacts of the technology. So we're using, more and more flash technology because it consumes a lot less power and still has very good performance. We do more and more things like turn off power to systems when they're not in use. So we're going to see a lot more impact around, doing things with technology to really save, energy costs and promote environmental concerns.
Mark Lewis, President of Content Management and Archiving at EMC Corporation, a Fortune 500 software and data storage company. They co-authored a study on the digital shadow. Mark, thanks so much.
Thanks, Robin.
And coming up, the forgotten Ellis Island. Back in 1 minute, here and now. 25 million immigrants came to America between 1880 and 1924. Half of them passed through New York's Ellis Island. We're familiar with the images of the tired and the poor crowding off the boat, carrying their bundles up the grand staircase at the receiving center. What you may not know is at the top of the stairs were health officials watching to see who couldn't make that climb, who may have a contagious disease or a mental illness. One in five arrivals were marked with chalk and sent to the Ellis Island Hospital for an exam.
And we went to this big, like an open room, and there were a couple of doctors there, and then they tell you to strip. And my mother had never, ever undressed in front of us. You know, those days, nobody ever would.
A new documentary, Forgotten Ellis Island, tells the story of that hospital. It began in 1902 and in less than 10 years had 1,000 beds spread over 22 buildings. The film shows the buildings, worn down by time but still elegant. Forgotten Ellis Island director Lori Conway joins us. And Lori, what was it like to be there?
Every time you would pinch yourself for the opportunity to be out there. The buildings are empty, abandoned, there is no furniture in them, and yet there's a sense of significance and history as you walk down this 500-foot spine-like hallway with the wards off of this spine-like hallway. And out many of these cracked windows is the Statue of Liberty or the skyline of Manhattan. You feel that this is truly a significant place.
You say it was where America's conflicting beliefs about immigration collided.
Indeed. This hospital, Robin, was both welcoming and foreboding. It was a place that detained you, often against your will, with language that you didn't understand. Even the food was exotic, let alone an X-ray. All of these things were foreign to the immigrant patients who, by the way, had to pay their hospital bills.
It was not a perfect system by any means, but there were reasons for fear because you also write, immigrants came carrying their hopes and their diseases. And this is in an age before antibiotics, so this was a place where also the germs of the world converged. And at this time in history, you remind us that Typhoid Mary had spread typhoid throughout New York City, and she was an immigrant.
Absolutely. She was an immigrant kitchen worker and spread death and panic by her contagious disease. This was indeed the era before antibiotics. Three times in the 19th century, cholera had crossed the Atlantic, and these germs of the world, typhoid, TB, polio, diphtheria, even measles and chickenpox, let alone cholera, were virulent. And they could spread epidemics throughout the nation, not just in New York.
And this caused some, you know, terrible scenes. You found people whose relatives had come through Ellis Island, and in some cases, families had been split up because of diseases. And even if they weren't, children might have been separated from families and stayed at the hospital. Let's just listen to some of the now adults talking about that experience.
They took me away from my mother. I didn't know what was happening. She didn't know what was happening. And I was here in this place away from her, never knowing if I was going to see her again.
Well, I was there 5 days before they decided that it was nothing contagious, that it was just a sore throat that had passed. And by the end of that time, I was used to the routine, but I still missed my parents and thought they had gone on without me.
Those are now adults talking about being children at the Ellis Island Hospital. And as you say in the film, although there were some heartbreaking stories of children actually sent back to their home country, most got well. 9 out of 10 got well and were free to become American citizens.
Indeed. And yet the separation and the anxiety of these diseases that doctors and nurses really couldn't fight at the turn of the 20th century was enough to traumatize people. And tens of thousands of people went through the hospital unknowing what was going to happen to them as they were lying in their bed sick and diseased, hoping to become citizens.
And often not sick, but perceived as sick, because as the story goes along, the hospital gets tangled up with the eugenics movement. In fact, a member of the eugenics movement is hired to work at the hospital. This is a movement that was dedicated to improving the racial pool, what now we know is phony science, measuring people's heads, trying to know by looking in their faces whether they were mentally ill. Tell us about some of those experiences.
As you noted before, the hospital, like any large bureaucracy, was not a perfect place. And within a decade of opening, Congress enacted laws against the entry of the feeble-minded. And what this law was all about, really, was targeting Italians, Jews, and Slavs who were coming in droves. And America was not as keen, and their strange, darker complexion faces was not the novelty that it once was. And so the feeble-minded was an exclusion, a very broad exclusion, that could determine the fate of a person who may not be as desirable as Americans was looking for. So many were deported as a result.
You meet a woman whose aunt was sent back after one of these phony medical exams. Let's listen.
My aunt was coming here, hopefully, to live here forever. She told my parents and her husband that when it came her turn to be questioned, they asked her, how many feet does a horse have? And she thought he was making a fool of her, that that was a stupid question. And she was detained on Ellis Island.
And that aunt, who was then a young girl who was sent back, died in the Holocaust. You know, these are heartbreaking stories, and they're mistakes. They're mistakes that the hospital made. But your conclusion is what? That these were mistakes from really well-intentioned people who were flawed.
Well, remember, eugenics was a hard science at the turn of the 20th century. It was introduced by Charles Darwin's cousin, Francis Galton, so it had instant credibility. And to tell you the truth, as droves of immigrants were coming in at the early part of the 20th century, the novelty of the immigrant was wearing off. And eugenics was a theory that said very credibly, American gene pool may be threatened by these newcomers. And so the feeble-minded and the mental tests were considered very legitimate. And it's important, as one of my scholarly advisors warned me during the research, to not use presentism and not to look at eugenics through a lens that we may look at it today.
And how should we look at the hospital through the lens of today? Because overall, you have people, you know, saying, overall, this was the most wonderful place, humane, warm, welcoming. In 1 year, it treated 10,000 patients from 75 countries, healing 90% of them. What is your thinking now about that hospital through this prism of today and the debate over immigration?
As the granddaughter of Irish immigrants, I am supportive of immigration. 100 million Americans trace their roots to the 12 million immigrants who came through Ellis Island. But what I think the research taught me is the need for control, the need for processing in a humane way the immigrants who are presenting themselves at our borders. Because that's really the legacy of Ellis Island, is the way in which people were not perfectly treated, but they were treated humanely. They were selectively processed at times, but they were processed humanely. And I think that's what America is all about. A century ago, confronting an overwhelming flow of immigrants, the United States built a hospital, not a fence. And I think that says it all.
That's Lori Conway, independent producer, filmmaker. Her documentary and book, Forgotten Ellis Island. To find out more, please go to our website, here-now.org. Lori, thanks.
Thank you so much for having me.
Here Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.